I'm here at my home in Tennessee with Sayer G. Sayer, so good to talk to you again.
Great to be here.
Thank you for traveling up from Florida to share some of your knowledge with us today. And we're going to hit a couple of big topics.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about vaccines. We're also going to talk about detox, and they really are kind of related, aren't they?
Absolutely. There's a lot of overlap, you know, with detoxification. It's a common problem, obviously. We're exposed to literally tens of thousands of novel new chemical compounds in the modern sort of post-industrial era. And so with vaccines, you know, this is one area where some of the things they're putting into our bodies, we can't take out, at least not easily. Some of those are viruses that actually integrate into the germline of our cells and will stay with our body for a very long time. So, you know, there's overlap. Mercury, you can take some of it out, not all of it. But yeah, the issues are definitely related.
Talk about the viruses. You mentioned viruses and vaccines. I mean, we know one vaccine that's very popular is the polio vaccine back in the 50s. We know that was laced with viruses, right?
Yeah, actually, the problem with the polio vaccine is that it's in the category of a live virus vaccine. So what they did is they took animal cells from another species, basically sort of a chimpanzee cell, and infected that cell with a virus, and then they used it to produce, you know, antigen or, you know, vaccine seed stock, which then they then gave to humans orally, which infected them with the virus. But when you do this process of mixing different types of animal fluids and different pathogens, they tend to adapt better to the body that you're infecting. And the immune system doesn't have an opportunity to react as strongly. And that's why they justify it, because you're not going to get full-blown polio, theoretically, if you take an oral polio vaccine. But what does happen is that the virus infects that person, and because the immune response isn't normal, it can stay in their body as sort of a surreptitious or low-grade infection. It could even last a lifetime. But another problem, of course, is that these cells of these other animals contain within them a number of what are known as endogenous retroviruses. And these viruses have the ability to insert into the DNA of other animals. So the chimpanzee cell in the nucleus has just hundreds of different potential viruses that when they make them into vaccines, they're reawakened and then can infect us. One of those viruses is actually known as simian virus number 40, or SV40. And the oral polio vaccine campaigns introduced this virus into literally millions of people unawares. And even today, I, for one, likely have SV40 in my body because my mom received the vaccine. So it gets passed down transgenerationally, even though I didn't receive that vaccine. So it stays in our body. It's passed down into future generations, potentially forever. And that is one of the sort of Pandora's box events that occurred in the history of vaccination.
And you know, you mentioned one of the things about vaccines is they bypass some of the typical immune responses, right? I mean, being directly injected is different than being exposed to something that maybe you breathe in through your nasal cavity.
Absolutely. Right? Exactly. The whole premise behind the efficacy of vaccination is that there's an observation that in nature, when a group of individuals are exposed to a wild type or natural infectious challenge, they meet the challenge, usually with things like fever, their immune system's activated, and then they survive, and then they have lasting immunity, which is why, for example, the CDC doesn't recommend that certain individuals that were born, I believe it's 1955 or earlier, get the measles vaccine, because they already have lifelong immunity from being exposed naturally. So it's kind of fascinating that today there's the assumption that if you don't vaccinate, then you could die from these natural infections, when in fact that natural process of meeting an infectious challenge, surviving it, and then having lifelong immunity is the basis for the entire validity of vaccination itself.
But then that begs the question, if these certain group of people don't need to be vaccinated because they have lifelong immunity, and if vaccination is equivalent to that, why do we need booster shots?
Well, yeah, and that's the problem, is that vaccination has never been shown to equate to bona fide immunity. And that's the assumption. In fact, the fact that we even call vaccines immunizations is so sort of almost like Orwellian, because immediately you have to assume that they work when you say that they're immunizations. Like when someone goes to a pediatrician and they say, well, I've been concerned about the potential my child might be harmed. I don't know whether I want to get these vaccines. And the pediatrician will be like, well, you don't believe in immunizing your child? I mean, when they put it in that term or terminology, it makes it seem as if you're endangering your own children.
Right, right. I agree. I mean, they've kind of co-opted the terms, because yes. Vaccination is not necessarily the same as immunization. It's not the same, is it?
It is not the same, yeah, because again, the basic premise behind vaccination is that you can reproduce synthetically a natural infection with the assumption that you can weaken, or what they call attenuate, the pathogen, so it doesn't cause as great a likelihood to, say, go into full-blown, febrile seizures, for example. It's ironic, however, because many of the live viruses that are in the schedule, a vaccine schedule, do produce febrile seizures at pretty high rates. So it's more likely that you're going to end up with a vaccine-induced febrile seizure if you look at the PDF inserts of the vaccines than naturally have one from fighting a common childhood infection, which, as we all know, has always been known to be relatively benign. If you have good sanitation, if you have good nutrition, if you have things like refrigeration, which they didn't have for quite some time, or even municipal water that is cleansed, then you wouldn't necessarily have the opportunity to have good immunity. So vaccination doesn't replace those conditions that we need to make a priority.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, if you look at many of the childhood diseases, vaccines are credited with causing them to be wiped out, but the reality is they were wiped out long before vaccines because of what you just mentioned.
Yes.
Right? Good
yes.
Sanitation, clean water, better living conditions, which then gave the immune system a chance, right?
Yeah, in fact, that's the most fascinating of all topic, because if you look at the work of Suzanne Humphreys, MD, she went into all of the epidemiological literature that exists from government databases and found that if you look at when the main vaccines that we are using still today, that are supposed to have saved millions of lives, like for measles, for example, were introduced, it was already at the end of this cycle of mass epidemics because of the introduction of things like refrigeration, municipal cleansed water, good nutrition protocols. These were all the real reasons why these epidemics start to fade away. And in fact, my research into the topic from the National Library of Medicine, you can look at the studies on Greenman Info, shows many health benefits have been identified for infection from things like measles. Some of those include reduction in cancer risk, reduction in cardiac mortality, a reduction in atopic disorders, which are very common, which are autoimmune related to things like dermatitis. So in fact, the theory is that it is essential for our immune system to develop and grow by meeting natural infectious challenges. If you take those away suddenly, what happens is the immune system blows back on itself, and you have what is really, in a way, a submerged iceberg of autoimmune conditions that emerge. Sometimes you call them Th2 dominant disorders, where the adaptive pole of the immune system, it has not been challenged again by normal infections or even germs in the environment, which are really bacteria, which we know now we are comprised primarily of. The microbiome is primarily, viruses, fungi, bacteria. So if we don't have infectious agents or germs to be helping us to educate our immune system, then we actually technically start blowing back on ourselves and falling apart.
Mm. It's interesting. When I was a kid, we used to have chickenpox parties. So, I mean, literally, if a kid got chickenpox, the other parents would expose their children to the chickenpox, get chickenpox, because that would confer lifelong immunity. They would never get it again.
Absolutely. In fact, that is what I would call immunization. It was a well-known way to confer natural immunity in a controlled way, because you knew eventually they might get it. And if they didn't end up getting the chickenpox early in life, it could then come up later when it could lead to severe issues like, basically it's herpes zoster, like a herpes-like infection in the eye that could cause blindness, which they're now finding is actually connected to the shingles vaccine, which is containing the live chickenpox virus still and can cause all types of adverse effects.
Well, you just mentioned package inserts.
Yeah.
Right? So it's kind of like this hidden in plain sight thing.
Yes.
Right? Because we know, I'm trying to remember properly the vaccine, I think it's the DPT vaccine for Sanofi Pasteur. I think it's called the Tripedia.
Okay.
On that insert, it says may cause autism. So, but then if you have a child that's vaccinated with a DPT that comes down with autism,
yes,
you're nuts. It didn't cause, it wasn't because of the vaccine, but it says it on the insert.
Yes.
So let's talk about vaccines that have been linked to autism, because the CDC whistleblower story is still really fresh.
Yes.
Dr. William Thompson, what's your take on that, Zaire?
Well, I think that I have to state the obvious, which is if you look at the acceleration of autism diagnoses in this country, it clearly is correlated with, in a causal way, cause and effect way, with the acceleration of the vaccine schedule. By no means is it the single cause. And that is, of course, how you always lose the argument. You can't just say vaccines cause autism without qualifying the statement, because there's so many other factors. If you look at the rates of the overuse of ultrasound, C-sections, Pitocin, Tylenol, all types of, you know, decreased breastfeeding duration, all types of fake synthetic foods. There's clearly hundreds of causes, but when you really look at what autism is, it is a vaccine-induced brain damage. And you can't tell the millions of parents that have watched their child regress suddenly from speaking, you know, at whatever month it was they received, for example, the MMR, and tell them that they didn't have a vaccine-injured child. And so what's happening at the CDC is that finally a senior scientist there was probably going to go into spiritual meltdown if he didn't disclose and blow the whistle on his agency, who clearly covered up the fact that the data showed a 240% increased risk in autism, and specifically African-American children, boys, when they received the MMR vaccine early. So it's clear that that's just the tip of the iceberg. The authors of the studies that were trying to say there was no link had published hundreds of papers that the CDC used to justify their, you know, bold-faced lie that there is no link with autism and vaccination. So now we have the whole house of cards imploding, because the model, of course, is this is evidence-based health policy, when in fact it's science by proclamation, which is in no way consistent with the model that you use, you know, the actual truth to, you know, influence how you, you know, apply, you know, health policies.
You know, and the travesty of justice to me is not just the fact that these kids, a lot of these kids are damaged or dead, but it's also we have parents being blamed for the death of their child when many times it could have been vaccine related. I mean, I think there at this point there are 3,000 Americans that are serving life in prison for damaging their, for murdering their baby, whether it's shaken baby syndrome or whatever they want to call it.
Yes.
And a large percentage of those received the vaccine, MMR, DPT, whatever it might be, within a couple of weeks of the time they died.
Yes.
But the parents have been blamed for shaking their baby. And the interesting thing is that the medical research shows, the coroner's reports,
yes,
the medical examiners, in many cases have shown that it could not have been from shaking the baby.
Absolutely. There's a new documentary coming out on this topic where one of the experts speaks to the fact that there's never been a case of brain damage where there isn't a neck injury, right? Where that person's brain was damaged. And that's apparently universally the case when it comes to the autopsies on shaken baby syndrome, is that there is no evidence that there was any kind of trauma, you know, applied to that infant. And so it's clear that when you look at the actual statistics, we reported on this recently at Greenman Info, is the CDC's own data shows that the primary window when SIDS supposedly occurs, a syndrome, is when most of the vaccines start to be applied in the schedule. So it's very early and it occurs at the same time, and I think the smoking gun is clearly vaccines.
Yeah, you mentioned SIDS. One of Charlene, my wife's best friends in Dallas, her second child died within a couple of weeks of vaccine.
Wow. Yeah.
he was crying, he was crying, he was crying. She didn't go to pick him up. He died.
Wow.
So the next morning, you know, they get the autopsy, whatever they call it, SIDS, which is basically a fig leaf to cloak the fact they have no idea why he died, or they're covering up the fact that he died from vaccines.
Exactly.
And to this day, her friend still thinks that she killed her baby. She let him cry to death.
That is amazing.
She thinks she let the baby cry to death.
That is amazing. It's so
I mean, so
sad.
Parents have this guilt that's associated with this. But when you think about it, how can someone cry to death?
Well, you know, there's a number of things happening here. One of them is there's a Stockholm syndrome effect as well. There's so many parents that observed damage occur after vaccination, but then we're told, of course, by the entire world, it's not the vaccines. So they identify, you know, with the aggressor ultimately, and they don't want to mourn in acknowledging because they would be enraged maybe for the rest of their life that they participated in the death or irreparable harm of their child. So what that does is it creates these very intense and seemingly unethical individuals out there that their whole goal is to try to attack those who are bringing awareness to this reality, this general, you know, epidemic. I mean, some use the word Holocaust. I think it's one of the most disturbing facts of our time that you can't even speak to the thing, you know, the basic facts like vaccine inserts that state that all of these potential harms are possible and have been observed previously. And you can't even speak to them without being called an anti-vaxxer, whatever that's supposed to mean.
Right.
So I find that to be a litmus test. If someone even uses the term, it's usually a reflection of either their own grief or a deep lack of education on the topic. So, you know, it's a very sad situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's interesting that parents that have been in that situation, I guess that is the Stockholm syndrome. They don't even want to admit at times that it could have been that choice.
Yes.
Right. I was watching a documentary by Dr. Gary Null.
Yes.
Vaccine Nation, I think he was called. Mm-hmm. But he followed the story of Alan Yurko, who did 8 years in jail in prison for shaking his baby. That it turns out he was released because all of the coroner's reports showed that it could not have been possible for him to have killed his baby.
Right.
But all along the way, you know, he's thought of as a baby murderer, and people that support him are thought of as conspiracy theorists.
Yes.
Because they dare to question vaccines, which, you know, Robert Scott Bell calls them the holy grail of the modern church of pharmaceutical mysticism.
It's so true. I mean, you can't really think of any other example of a compulsory medical intervention beyond maybe water fluoridation, where there's absolutely no attempt at informed consent, putting a pharmaceutical product in your water.
Yeah.
But with vaccination, they're making it now appear that if you do not comply with the ever-expanding schedule, because there's over 271 vaccines in the pipeline right now, I mean, it is a feeding frenzy as far as the opportunity to profit from the pharmaceutical perspective. But if you don't comply fully, they make it seem as if you're doing violence not just to your own child, but to children around you. And of course, any common sense approach would acknowledge that if the vaccines work, why are you so afraid of my child not getting them, right? That is a subconscious acknowledgement that they don't even believe they work.
Yeah.
So why would you vaccinate your child if you're afraid that the non-vaccinated would infect your child? Because aren't they supposed to confer superpowers? So it's an absurdity. And of course, as you know, the live vaccines like MMR actually cause infection in those individuals that can shed and then transfer viral particles to those who are not vaccinated. So it's actually the opposite. Instead of, quite frankly, what's going on, it's like saying your child who's not vaccinated needs to put a yellow star on their lapel, and that if they don't comply, you know, they're doing harm and attacking other children with their non-vaccination status. It's really disturbing.
Well, I think you're right. It's actually the opposite of that, isn't it? It's the those that have been vaccinated are actually the ones that are potentially shedding and causing these epidemics, and that's what we've seen.
Absolutely, and in fact, when you're looking at, for example, Paul Offit, who is now presently the spokesperson for vaccine safety, has a patent on the rotavirus vaccine, which has been already acknowledged to have so many problems because of surreptitious viruses. You know, porcine circovirus was discovered in the Rotatec virus vaccine. Then you have the discovery of what are known as endogenous retroviruses within vaccines like the Rotatec, which are able to infect children with a virus that goes into potentially their germline, which means that it can be passed down to the next generation. Mm-hmm. These viruses, it's a retrovirus. It's the same category as HIV, which is associated with AIDS, right? These are very problematic, if not potentially cancerous viruses. In fact, Judy Mikovits, who's on our advisory board, wrote a book called The Plague.
Plague.
And it's all about what has been known for quite some time.
She just sent me a copy yesterday.
Oh, it's an amazing book. It is so important that if you haven't heard it, that's probably why, because they are doing everything in their power to suppress this woman's work. They literally put her in jail for her advocacy and her discovery, because they were so scared of the implications. It means that the entire biologicals category of pharmaceuticals, which includes vaccines and blood products and monoclonal antibodies, may be infected with viruses that literally cause cancer and all types of neurological issues. And there's no way you can recall them because they're in the actual vaccine production process themselves. It's interesting because when they first started thinking about ways to produce vaccines, they were going to take cancer cells. The CDC had discussions about this, but they were concerned because although cancer cells are perfect, they can produce an infinite supply of vaccine antigen because they're immortal. They just keep reproducing. It's rather disgusting and gross, right? But they were concerned because they thought there could be a what they call oncogenic factor in there. It's cancer, so maybe if you grew these vaccines out of cancer cells, it could cause cancer. So they're, you know what, we're not going to use human cancer cells, we're going to use animal cells instead. And so they chose not to use cancer cells from animals, but regular animal cells, thinking, oh, well, this is safer. They didn't know at the time that there was this thing called reverse transcriptase, which is an enzyme that can take genetic information from another species and put it into the genome of a species like a human. Mm. And so only after they developed all these vaccines from the animals did they realize that hidden within this vaccine seed stock were all these viruses that they didn't know. And so then they put them into the bodies literally of millions of people. Simian virus 40 with oral polio vaccines was the first example. Even Morris Hilleman acknowledged that they were causing cancers, and this is documented, but this is just the tip of the iceberg.
What exactly is a retrovirus?
Well, retrovirus is able to insert from another species' DNA genetic information into the germline of another. Okay. So basically, we all have in our genome all these sequences of ancient viral infections that have been called endogenized infections. They came from another species, entered into our germline, and became part of our DNA. Over time, we survived, and actually, it confers some benefits, theoretically. What happens is that between species, there's sort of like this massive division. You're not supposed to, say, mix the brain cells of a mouse in with a human cell, let it fester and ferment, and then, you know, take an extract of that and put it into another animal cell. Well, guess what? This sort of like Holdren-like process is how they developed many of the first vaccines. And so even like the MMR vaccine or many vaccines in the schedule today take human aborted fetal cells, diploid cells they're called, sort of to cover up the fact that they were harvested from intentionally aborted fetuses to be produced as antigen for vaccines that are being injected, mind you, into those that it completely violates their religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. If you're a Christian, for example, I think that it's pretty clear you don't want to support abortion, and nor do you want to inject the byproduct of an aborted fetal cell into your own child to confer a health benefit to them.
Yeah. That doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it's terrible.
And that's just the beginning of the toxic slew of chemicals that are in many vaccines. You know, there was a Facebook post just a couple of days ago, and I talked about this on my radio show just last night.
Yes.
Where a mother got on this thread, and she acted like she was going to begin giving her children supplements that her doctor had recommended, which included aluminum, formaldehyde, thimerosal, all the ingredients that are in vaccines. But she said that these were supplements that the pediatrician had recommended that she give her child. She wanted to see the reaction.
Yes.
She got lambasted on Facebook. There were even people that were threatening to call CPS on her
to
take her kids because she was she could kill the kids. And at the end of the post, she said, "This was just an example to show you what's in these vaccines. Look at the way you reacted to me, but we put them in our, we let pediatricians inject them into our kids."
That is such a profound example because, as you mentioned, the route of exposure is everything. You know, in nature, when you're infected, for example, by rotavirus or polio, which is a relatively harmless enterovirus, normally does not cause any of the neurological damage that we associate with polio paralysis. But regardless, is you orally ingest it, which then there's a whole layer of immune defense. It's primarily located in the alimentary canal because that's the interface between the environment and your body. That's your immune system saying this is let in, this isn't. You don't inject that ingredient directly into the tissue of the body because then all of the hundreds of biological processes and defenses against entering your body can't be activated. And even some of the benefits, again, of being challenged by measles and other viruses that help to create a sort of tolerance in our immune system and self-tolerance are eliminated. So imagine that. They get so upset that, you know, you would even think to give your child orally thimerosal, even though, of course, amalgam is 50% mercury. We all still don't think about that. Or, you know, formaldehyde, but they'd be okay. And actually, they would be afraid if your pediatrician didn't inject it into their children's bodies.
But yeah, Sayer, you know, one of the things that I've shared with you before is, you know, when our first child, Brianna, was born, we didn't know what we do today about vaccines.
Yes.
We were starting to learn.
Yes.
And we were reading some of the research out there that they could be harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know that, especially at this time, this was early 2000, at that time there was a lot of hit pieces out there as well, just like there are today. So for every article that you would read that the vaccines are dangerous, you'd have 10 that said, anybody that says vaccines are dangerous is crazy.
Yes.
So we decided to go ahead and vaccinate. Well, we actually confronted the pediatrician first and asked the pediatrician.
Yes.
And we were, I was not there, but Charlene conveyed the story to me. She said that we're thinking about not vaccinating because we were concerned about the dangers. And the pediatrician looked at her and said, if you don't vaccinate, you are not welcome at this clinic.
Mm.
You can find another doctor.
Wow.
You know, if I knew then what I know now, I would have said, take a hike,
exactly.
We fire you. But we didn't, at that time, we didn't want to lose the pediatrician, right?
Absolutely.
Really respected pediatrician in Pittsburgh.
Exactly.
So we stayed and we got her vaccinated. We learned later that was a mistake, but you know, for a long while, and even still at times we think, wow, I can't believe we did that.
Yes.
But we didn't know. It was ignorance.
Yes. Well, Ty, I mean, I can identify with your story. For me, it's interesting. I got into this even before I had children. I was very fortunate because, you know, doing the type of work I did, which was really trying to get the word out about the research supporting natural medicine, I started to look into vaccines because I was surprised. You know, when I looked at the what they call meta-analysis of all the literature ever published on vaccines, there's a particular independent scientific body called the Cochrane Collaboration, highly respected, because what they do is they look at all the studies, they try to really identify if there's, say, industry influence. Because as you know, there's no real regulation as far as publishing studies. If you have a null or negative finding, you don't have to publish it. But if you have a positive one, you could be a vaccine manufacturer and spend 20 years and finally get a study that looks like, okay, there's a little bit of a relative risk reduction in some disease. And you publish that, and then that's all you see. Well, what they did, they looked at all the research on childhood vaccines and all the research on vaccines for healthy adults and elderly and those who work on the elderly. And none of the Cochrane review conclusions showed that they were proven safe or effective. Mm-hmm. In fact, in children under 2, they only found 2 studies ever performed on safety, and only one of them may have indicated that there was a potential that it wasn't harmful. So it just blew my mind. I was like, how could this possibly be? Because, you know, we were dealing with swine flu and being told, oh, it's a global pandemic. You know, we have to vaccinate everyone on the planet immediately. And it was so clear to me that there's no example that is more instructive when it comes to identifying how, you know, twisted and Orwellian the medical system is today.
Mm.
And that there is absolutely no clinical support for the statement that vaccines are safe and effective, because there's not been a single true placebo-controlled trial ever performed on any vaccine in the schedule, much less any combination vaccine much less all 60 vaccines together that they're giving our children. So when you really look at the emperor, he or she's been naked the entire time. There's this science by proclamation, meaning the CDC says, and then they put one reference to a study that was clearly manipulated and or that was already, it should be retracted because of course, the CDC whistleblower affair. So when people really look at the vaccine problem from the perspective of the evidence, there really is no true evidence.
You know, it seems that if vaccines were safe and effective, that they could perform a study at any time to prove this. And there are no studies.
None. There's not a single study on the vaccine group versus a non-vaccinated group.
They've never done it.
They know why, because if they were ever to do that, injected one control group, right, with saline, they would find them to be healthier. And so we have sort of naturalistic data through the Amish who have extremely low levels of autism because they don't vaccinate. And they live relatively healthy environment. You know, they have all the good things we're talking about, exposure to natural microbes in their environment, good nutrition, they have, you know, clean water. And that's what you need to have natural immunity.
Yeah, and they also aren't exposed to the EMF to the degree that we are either.
No, yeah, EMFs are a huge problem because, you know, we are an electromagnetic organism and our gene expression is highly influenced by these types of wavelengths. So that's an invisible factor that isn't even really addressed, but is certainly a big part of the problem.
Could that be part of the vaccine or the autism problem? Not just vaccines, but also the EMFs in conjunction with the poor nutrition. I mean, just it's kind of a multifaceted issue, isn't it?
Yeah, if you think about what people do today, they take a microwave device. This will literally heat my brain in a matter of minutes and affects the alpha waves almost immediately. And their children are literally exposing themselves and adults to a microwave. You know, you don't have like nerve receptors in your brain to be able to feel it. But if you did, there would be probably some pain. And this is like just a fraction of what they're being exposed to. You go to a place in New York City, there's 100 Wi-Fi connections popping up on your phone at any given moment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty significant problem. Mm.
Yeah, so Sayer, what do you have to say to parents out there that may be holding, you know, some guilt over vaccinating their child and they later learn that they did some damage or they don't know if they've done some damage? I mean, what's your message to them?
Well, I mean, I'm so excited for the fact that this information exists and the folks that are tuned in are very much aware of how they got to this point where they're looking for the type of information they don't find in the mainstream or through the CDC or through their pediatrician. And so they're acknowledging that there's a potential that the vaccines have caused neurological problems, perhaps behavioral and physical problems. And so they're looking at ways to address that damage and to not make the same mistake. And the good news is that, you know, while there is irreparable damage that can occur, I mean, even as we age, naturally, some things will never come back, there is so much resilience in the human body. And to know that we have potentially contributed to the harm because we didn't know or we listened to the wrong authorities or, you know, externalized our agency to authorities, to know that we maybe contributed is also the first step in acknowledging we have the power to truly change the circumstances for our children and for others to learn from our wisdom now. So there is so much that the body can do to heal, as you, of course, know because you advocate this so well. So first of all, natural immunity. What's the best way to support natural immunity? Well, guess what? Sunlight exposure is probably one of the best ways to address that, which implies going outdoors, which implies being connected and doing hopefully nourishing things as a family, you know, outside. I mean, these are not just things we do to pass time or aesthetic pleasures. They're essential to the health of the human body, especially children. Good food, of course. And when we mean good food, we mean food that is truly grown in organic soil, if not better, permacultured biodynamic soil or from your local farmer's market where you know the farmer. Clean water, which is, if we don't make that a priority, 99% of the molecules in our body are water by number. You know, that is an amazing fact. And without good quality water, you know, I source whenever I can from, you know, like Mountain Valley, for example. It's a relatively protected aquifer in glass. I mean, that I see that as an elixir of health and immunity and helping me to repair damage. Because that's part of the story I didn't tell you. I actually was a vaccine-injured child. 6 months of age, I was a severe bronchial asthmatic. And I recall that that seemed to have been very formative in who I am today and why I'm so into educating people about a better way. Mm. So yeah, there's a lot that we can do, and certainly understanding that you are not to blame for the fact that there's a $1 trillion industry trying to convince you every moment that your natural instinct to not vaccinate and to do all these good natural things is somehow wrong or unethical or even illegal. You know, I mean, thank God for this type of opportunity to share this information. Mm.
So the treatment is actually the prevention in this case, right? You mentioned earlier that a lot of these childhood type diseases were virtually wiped out from what? Clean water, good nutrition, the things that you just mentioned,
yes.
Right? So they not only prevented or they stopped these epidemics, but they are also ways that you can treat if someone's already been vaccinated.
Yeah, and actually in many ways, the existence of natural infectious challenges, you know, communally acquired, like your chickenpox party, is fundamental to health. So if we were to, quote, eradicate polio or measles as if that were ever a possibility that would be worth considering, you know, you hear Bill Gates say on interview with Sanjay Gupta on CNN that parents who don't vaccinate are responsible for killing children. You realize that we are in an era where insanity is the norm and institutionalized, and the rhetoric is so extreme that we need to acknowledge that if it's a natural infection, that is the basis for the entire superstructure of why people think vaccines even work or herd immunity exists, because they observed in nature that when you survive natural infectious challenges, the community as a whole became healthier. But you don't remove that from the equation. We need germs. We are germs. In fact, most of our genetic material, 99% of it, is from microbes, viruses, fungi, and bacteria. So how does the CDC and how does conventional immunology and vaccinology explain that fact? They don't, because they haven't caught up with the research. This is only 15 years old, this research.
And it's interesting that you mention the bacteria, the fungi, the viruses. It takes me back to the age-old battle between Pasteur and Bouchamp, right? The internal terrain.
Yes.
Pasteur said that the germs, the bacteria, are the problem, so we need to get rid of them.
Yes.
And Bouchamp said, no, it's not the germs that are the problem. It's people that get sick, it's because they have internal terrain that is susceptible to getting sick. So we should work on our bodies, the microbiome. He didn't know what it was called then.
Yes. Yes.
Versus get rid of all bad germs.
Absolutely.
That's the fundamental problem. That's the clash that's still going on today, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. In fact, when you acknowledge this notion that we are constituted by this ancient relationship between all of these microbes, you know, that Pasteur considered to be the primary target for disease eradication, you realize just how truly obscene and, you know, medieval on some level our disease model is, and that by believing in this myth, we have created the very monster that we thought we were fighting. The bioweapons community alone, in what they've created in an attempt to produce some type of inoculant or some kind of vaccine against a bioweapons attack, in their laboratories, they have created some of the most monstrous opportunities for the very type of lethality and transmissibility of things like avian flu virus, for example. By testing and creating this stuff, they've actually created the possibility for there to be a real sort of apotheosis of the germ theory, a sort of apocalyptic scenario the CDC keeps mentioning about there's a nightmare pathogen that we have no defenses against. It's really remarkable.
They're creating it
out of their fear that it exists. They've actually brought it into reality. And so, you know, that's one of the dangers, is that I believe the terrain is everything, but unless we also truly become aware of what's going on and the intrinsic just disease promoting properties of vaccines, we will never be able to have a world that's truly safe for our children.
You mentioned herd immunity just a minute ago, Sayer. Herd immunity never dealt with, the original concept of herd immunity didn't even deal with vaccines, did it?
No, I mean, it's based on the observation, you know, that a group of individuals or animals, for example, will survive and thrive in many ways after being challenged with an infection. Now, it is possible that a member will die, but those who survive are have greater fitness. So there's an element to it that's almost Darwinian as far as, you know, the way that nature's set up is that if we look at what's going on today presently, for example, the way that artificial insemination and all these external life support systems helping to prop up the diseased Western body are enabling us to survive and reproduce, ultimately what will happen is at some point, I mean, we're already seeing that reproduction levels are extremely low, is that we as a species won't be able to carry on the billions of years of fitness that have been conferred into our body through the natural process of meeting challenges, you know? So, yeah, we're in a different situation today.
We're toxic. We're toxic from vaccines, but we're toxic from a lot of other causes, right? I mean, the air, the water, the food, I mean, everything that we're exposed to is toxic today compared to 100 years ago. So let's talk about some ways that if we are toxic from the air, the water, the food, vaccines, whatever it might be, how can we get rid of the toxins? What are some good general principles?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I just add one thing about the HIV vaccine
yeah.
and molecular mimicry?
What do you want me to ask? What question are we to ask to get you there?
Let me see. Maybe just ask about the HPV vaccine just so I can just hit that one.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
So one of the vaccines that's very popular today that I personally think is absurd is the HPV vaccine. And there's a lot of reasons I think it's absurd, but what's your take on it?
Well, it is a unique vaccine in the sense it's the most expensive vaccine ever produced, $150 a dose. It is also a genetically modified vaccine. And this is a really important issue to me because there are activists that are promoting the awareness of GMO harms, but they're not looking at the reality, which is that some of the very same interests and companies and corporations behind GMOs are behind vaccines. So for example, March Against Monsanto, great movement, really appreciate it. But actually Monsanto is a subsidiary of Pharmacia, which is owned by Pfizer, one of the largest vaccine manufacturers and lobbyists that are partially responsible for why everyone's being vaccinated. So we need to start looking at the crossover because a lot of the GMOs being produced today are designed to produce edible antigens so that it will literally be an edible vaccine. And then you look at the vaccines like HPV, and they are being produced through genetically modified yeast where they produce HPV particles but also contain literally thousands of other proteins. And here's the point. If you think about the way that we think about vaccines, okay, you have a measles vaccine, you think, oh, there's one antigen they're injecting. Or if it's HPV, oh, they're just injecting the HPV antigen and our immune system's gonna react to that and clear it. That's not what's going on. The yeast proteome, it's called, the total set of proteins, is in the thousands. And it turns out 33% of these proteins overlap identically with human proteins. What that means is when you inject these vaccines, along with all of these proteins, your immune system's reacting to literally thousands of proteins producing antibodies, which then can produce self-antigens or self-antibodies, which then attack the body. So that may explain why, of all the vaccines that have ever been produced, the HPV vaccine seems to have the most adverse events reports, including emergency room visits associated with it, as well as reports of deaths. So this is a whole new territory. The genetically modified vaccine movement is now moving to DNA vaccines, and this is even DARPA funded. What they're doing is taking a virus, injecting it into the human body so that it infects certain cells, turning them into vaccine antigen producing factories. So the theory is they can take part of our cells, turn them into vaccine producing factories, and that's going to help us with our immunity. So the trajectory is actually towards what they would call transhumanism, which is the belief that we are naturally completely incapable of surviving, and we have to actually transmogrify into some kind of superhuman or future human form that requires we alter even the DNA in our body to be able to survive.
Wow, that almost seems related to the eugenics that was promoted by the Galtons and those families of 200 years ago that believed that we could create a superhuman race by only breeding with the elites.
Absolutely. It's a new form in the sense that they're proposing. Let's say they have this vaccine in the market and you don't take it. Well, what are you doing saying that you don't want to protect everyone else in the world from the potential that you could be a walking bioinfection? Mm-hmm. Because that's the way they're classifying being infected presently by Novel forms of influenza, for example. Executive orders were passed which made it basically a quarantinable offense to be infected by novel forms of influenza. And also, Obama signed an executive order that implies that infection with an Ebola-like agent would also warrant potential quarantine. So by redefining what it means to be infected as almost like a bioterrorism event, our freedoms have been completely eviscerated. So for me, I have two daughters, and when that happened, something shifted in me. Because it's clear to me that in this world they now live in, it is very likely at some point, especially depending on what state they live in, that they will be told that they have to inject something into their body. Now, as I understand it, the moment the state wields that sort of power over our bodies, that redefines us as chattel or property, because that means that we don't even have the basic right to bodily self-possession. So without the choice to basically involve ourselves, we are essentially identifying ourselves as slaves or objects. And that is something that I think many, especially mothers and parents, you know, who have children who are being faced with the question, should I vaccinate according to the schedule? Can I trust my pediatrician who's telling me we have to do this? They don't fully understand that the moral, you know, right is behind them. They have as parents the right and even the responsibility to choose what's best for their children, no matter what the state states is their power over them. That's pretty fundamental. One thing too that's really important is that pediatricians are actually like foot soldiers to the CDC, which is like a military organization. They literally wear uniforms, and it's a top-down command situation. So if a pediatrician does not abide by the standards of vaccination and promulgate them, then they themselves become legally liable for being sued. So even if they're open and they're like, oh, well, she doesn't want to vaccinate according to the schedule, and then someone actually gets injured or gets an infection, then they themselves could be legally liable. Whereas they are completely expunged of all liability if they follow without any thought the vaccine schedule. So anyone going to a pediatrician expecting good advice on vaccines, it's like going to a butcher and asking about veganism, what their thoughts on veganism are.
No. Doesn't work, does it?
Doesn't work, yeah.
Perhaps people are trying to juggle between the two pain, like the pain of resisting that system is too great, so they go to the other one. But truly, I mean, the outcomes that could result from that and that are likely, yes, even, truly is a much more painful reality.
Yes, I empathize profoundly with parents because they're in a situation where they may know that the MMR vaccine is not worth the risk at the very least. And they may know that they have a legal right as a parent to make these choices, and an ethical one, certainly. It's even a duty, not even a right, in my opinion. But they also are working with a system that will send everyone in their life the message that they are harming their child or putting them in danger's way, along with all the other children on the planet, if they make this decision. And so it is a growing movement. There are literally millions of people out there that are here to support that same decision, but they're not going to find that information on the CDC site. They're not going to find it on CNN. They're going to find it in events like this and the growing community that's behind us.
Yeah.
So they're not alone. Just remember that you have the right to choose, and it is something that's sacred.
And I think that that's no better exemplified than the mass exodus that we're seeing from California right now, right?
Wow.
They passed a mandatory vaccine law. People are saying, no, I'm leaving.
Absolutely. Of all states to fall, I was just shocked that it would be California. You know?
Me too. I would think that the crunchy granola state would have been the last to pass that kind of a law. But yeah, it's interesting. There was, Senator Pan is the senator that was responsible for that legislation.
Yes.
And by the way, he was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars by the pharmaceutical industry, the vaccine industry.
Absolutely.
But I recently saw a video of him along with Andy Wakefield and Del Bigtree, the producers of Vaxxed.
Yes.
Did you see it?
I did see it, yeah.
Where he's running, he runs down the hall to get away from them?
Literally runs, yeah. He knows, I think, what he's responsible for doing as far as taking away people's constitutional rights, you know, to exercise their religious and philosophical freedom to you know, not vaccinate, but he is running, literally. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that. I mean, what a coward. The guy introduces legislation to take away the parents' right to choose,
yes,
you know, medical intervention or not, and he doesn't even have the cojones to stop and take an interview to talk about his influence.
It's amazing.
That has literally caused millions of people to leave California,
yes,
and has also caused millions of other children to be injected with vaccines that would have never been injected, but he doesn't even have the intestinal fortitude to do an interview about it.
It's amazing.
Wow. I had no respect for him before, and I have even less now,
yeah,
after seeing that. So let's say we have these people across the country that are toxic. We have children that are toxic. We're all toxic to an extent.
Yeah.
So what's the solution? How do we detoxify this toxic stew that we're exposed to every day?
Well, one of the things that I know works really well is sweating. You know, the research is very compelling because if you do certain types of assays, say blood levels of toxicants, which are petrochemicals usually, and you can include heavy metals in that, you'll find not necessarily high markers, but when you do a study where you sweat intensely and see what's excreted, it's indicative that our bodily burden of toxicity is far higher than what is even measurable. And the amount of both petrochemicals and metals that are exuded and then eliminated are very significant. So it has led me to believe that if one isn't, at least on a, you know, 2 or 3 times a week basis, putting yourself in a position where you have enough exertion to sweat, and of course use heat, power yoga is a great way to do it, saunas, then you're putting yourself in harm's way. Because the bodily burden, even just in our air we're breathing, I guarantee you if we tested it right now, there would be some small amount of Roundup, you know, which is
sure,
such a prevalent toxicant at this point. But we have so much exposure that we have to, on a daily basis, engage these really ancient detoxification systems.
Mm. And so, yeah, I would agree with that. And when we look at the lifestyle that we live today compared to a century ago, we're less active. We sweat less, plus we're exposed to all these toxins that were not around then.
Yes.
So it's like a double whammy on us, right? We're becoming more toxic because of our exposure to things that weren't around.
Yes.
And, you know, your typical person, the most exercise that they get in a day is when they get up off the TV or get up off the sofa to go get a beer.
Yeah.
And then they go sit down. I mean, how many people do you know that don't ever exercise?
It's true. And you know, one of the things about exercise we don't often think about is when you're pushing yourself to the point of feeling like you're going to die, and then you survive and you feel that, like, usually this ecstasy and this, like, wow, I made it, you know, a lot's going on a physiological level. But one of the things is called mitochondrial biogenesis. So the so-called powerhouses of the cell are able to regenerate when you exert yourself in enough where you really feel like, wow, I've really pushed my envelope. And those mitochondria are essential for regulating our cells. They even regulate programmed cell death. It's involved in cancer, not just energy. And then you have stem cells, which are the magical immortal cell line in our body that has been inherited from all previous ancestors. Those stem cells also are able to go through division process and help to regenerate tissue that's damaged or so high in toxicant burden that it's better that they go through programmed cell death and those toxins are released and taken out of the body than to continue to live, because they can transmogrify their phenotype, so to speak, into cancerous or harmful behavior. Mm. So in many ways, exercise performs quite a lot of functions to regenerate the body as well as remove the chemicals that are accumulating.
So, Sarah, you know, I think most people don't typically think of exercise as being a way to detox, but you just explained that it really is important in detoxification.
Absolutely. And, you know, our lymphatic system doesn't have a pump, you know, like the heart, you know, pumps the blood. So when we're doing this intense movement, we're also just completely helping to flush all of the, you know, toxicants and help our immunity in a way that is not possible without this type of movement.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's many, many benefits from exertion of that kind.
Yeah, you know, an interesting thing that we've talked about previously that I want you to share with the viewers is the relationship of the petrochemical industry to this discussion.
Thank you. Yeah, this is a huge issue because what's going on is that presently we have a very outdated model of how we ascertain toxicant risk. You know, it's sort of like a dose response model, very linear. You have this amount of something and it causes this effect, and the more of it you have, the more effect you have, and that's how you, you know, ascertain whether something's harmful. And that's not what's going on, because new research on endocrine disruptors, for example, small amounts of petrochemicals could be paraben, for example, which is in a lot of body care products as a preservative, or bisphenols, which are everywhere because plastic is needing a plasticizer, and that's what they use. Bisphenol A, bisphenol S, bisphenol F, there's an alphabet soup of these. And when they say bisphenol A on the label now, unfortunately, they just replaced it with another bisphenol of equal toxicity. Small, small, small amounts have huge effects because they act like hormones. So the dose response linear concept has been completely supplanted by acknowledging that in some cases, the smaller the amount of toxicant you have in your body, the greater effect it could have on changing a cell's entire phenotype makeup into a cancer cell, for example. So this is not just for petrochemicals. This is actually for particle size. So you have this sort of innovation of nanoparticle technology. Titanium dioxide, for example. They use it to glaze, you know, pills white and use it for sunscreen. The particles are so small, we're talking, you know, maybe under 50 nanometers, that they can go right into the pores of the body. And when they attach to the surface of cells, can actually activate the nuclear machinery inside the cell, which changes the cell's phenotype. So previously, the idea was the dose makes the poison. If you have something really small, you know, it's not going to cause a great effect and it can't hurt you. Now we know that the smaller the particle size, the more harmful it can be. Another example of this is radioisotopes. Now we live in a world where nuclear pollution is everywhere. After the atom testing, for example, globally, we had uranium and plutonium concentrations you could measure in almost any sample. Now we have the fallout from Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima, and you have power plants that just naturally give off plumes of over 2,000 man-made or anthropogenic radionuclides just through releasing the steam from these basically pressure cookers as refueling. And so we have these radionucleotides everywhere in extremely low doses. When they first came up with the toxicity risk model, it was based on Hiroshima blast survivors. And they assumed that, you know, the real danger is gamma radiation exposure from the outside in, and they sort of averaged the dose by the amount of tissue exposed and came up with a calculation of risk. Well, unfortunately, that didn't explain what happens when exceedingly small amounts of these elements get into your body. You could have one atom of plutonium lodged in your body forever, and it's like literally giving off a sort of thermonuclear effect on that cell and the tissue around it for the rest of your life, causing all types of cancer, for example. Uranium-238, right, which is the basis for most of the nuclear power, as well as for DU, depleted uranium munitions, it has a half-life of 4.4 billion years, okay? That's longer than the age of the Earth, which means it's always going to be here. There's a study from the Army's Radiobiology Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, that was published, that shows that there are several thousand, if not 100,000 orders of magnitude higher toxicity associated with uranium-238 exposure than present radiation risk models allow for. So what I'm really referring to is the fact that when you really look at toxicant, heavy metal, radiation exposures today, less is actually more in certain ways. And you know, it's a dismal scenario, but I think the public really needs to know this information, because what's happened is the radiation risk models, toxicant risk models, make it seem as if you could expose yourself to large amounts of chemicals every day and it's okay. The way they actually come up with these risk assessments is they do the LD50 model. Yeah. Take animals, give them a lethal dose of a chemical that will kill 50% within a certain range of time. There's the acute, you know, toxicity model, say it's two days. And then they say, oh, let's extrapolate from the animal model. What's an acceptable level of harm for a human, assuming they can just look at body weight and calculate what is an acceptable rate?
Right.
Well, of course that model is insane. First of all, there's no such thing as an acceptable level of harm in my book. If you apply the precautionary principle, the moment a manufacturer has something that could do harm, well, guess what? The burden should be on them to prove it safe to the consumer. That's not what happens. They use this other model, release it into the environment and into consumer products, and then only after many years, sometimes decades, and cancer rates start to spike,
Do the consumers themselves have to raise the money, the political capital, to prove through what they call the weight of evidence model that they may have been harmed?
So what is the light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, the light at the end of the tunnel is that every moment our body is utilizing highly complex detoxification systems, which in some way almost anticipated the chemical revolution. The cytochrome P450 system, right, that is largely centered in the liver, is able to take a broad range of modern xenobiotics, which are foreign chemicals, and there's hundreds of thousands of them now, and somehow find a way to make these fat-loving chemicals water-soluble and help to, you know, through the phase one and two detoxification systems, and help to remove them from the body. So in many ways, you know, God, the intelligence of the universe, put us in a position where we can actually survive what should be a sort of lethal phase in our evolution as a species, which is to create this chemical nightmare.
It's very similar to my wife Charlene often says, you know, people ask, you know, why are babies born sick? Well, it's because of the fact that they're getting chemicals through the umbilical cord, right?
Yes.
A lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But the real question is, how are any babies born healthy? Right?
Thank you.
And that's really, and it's because we are resilient. The bodies are resilient. And so I think the takeaway from this is, if we provide our bodies with the nutrition that they need, if we supply the immune system with its nourishment that it needs, the body can actually be really amazing at fending off these toxins.
Absolutely, because that's the part I would like to focus on, is the idea that there are now compounds identified in common foods like broccoli, for example, ginger, garlic, that are so powerful at enhancing our natural detoxification systems. So broccoli extract has sulforaphane, which is a molecule that I've identified through the research on the Natural Library of Medicine to have over 100 health benefits. And I'm at the point in my research now where I believe that we ate these cruciferous and sulfur-containing vegetables for so long that our bodies have co-adapted, if you will, to needing them on a daily basis. So why do we develop cancer? Yeah, chemical exposure is one of the reasons. Well, you know, another one is deficiency of vegetables and phytocompounds. You can't say that radiation chemotherapy deficiency causes cancer, but you can say that a deficiency of broccoli or other, you know, phytochemical rich, detoxifying, enhancing vegetables can lead to cancer. And that's a profound fact. So when people really look at what they're eating, and they focus on these really therapeutic detoxifiers, then they will be assured that at least many of the harms can be mitigated.
Well, so broccoli is a great example. Give me some other foods that maybe we should be eating on a daily basis that we're not.
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the most acknowledged beneficial detoxifiers are things like parsley, cilantro, ginger. Probably one of my favorite of all is turmeric, because if you look at the research on its abilities to help prevent, you know, and to even treat a wide range of conditions, it certainly has a great reputation as far as even doing things like chelating metal in the body and neutralizing a lot of the toxicity of the modern age.
And you just named four or five foods there that the majority of people, at least in the United States, I can speak for us here, never eat.
They don't eat.
Ever.
Well, what's interesting is that even common, you know, American cultural traditions, like drinking coffee all day long, have been shown to activate detoxification pathways in the body. So inadvertently, many of us are already doing things in our diet that are helping to balance out sort of the harms. There's also things like whey, which, you know, as a bodybuilder, you know, is very good for building muscle, but it's also full of cysteine, a sulfur-containing molecule that helps to build glutathione, which is a powerful detoxifier in the body as well as antioxidant. So I like to look at the different ways we can use foods as enhancements to our, you know, detoxification.
Yeah, I think that the Dr. Mercola last year in the documentary that we did called The Global Quest, he said something that was just profound, but it was so simple.
Yeah.
Eat real food. Right? Eat
yes,
real food.
Eat real
because
food.
Think of the people today that we live in the United States, that we live next to, that are frequenting the fast food joints three times a day. That's their meals.
Yes.
They don't ever cook. They go eat processed, genetically modified junk.
Yes.
And if we would really be just on the right track if we would just start adhering to that concept to eat real food, wouldn't we?
It's a beautiful concept. I mean, it's so simple, really. Eat food that dies, because if it doesn't, it'll probably kill you, literally. Like, so perishability is actually a sign of quality and life energy that's going to help you to detoxify and manage, you know, your health.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, the enzyme, you got the enzymes in real food.
Yes.
You got the phytonutrients.
Yes, totally. Know. Oh, all right, there's one. One of the best things that's ever been researched post-Chernobyl was the use of apple pectin to take out from all these children's bodies all of these radioisotopes they'd accumulated, like cesium-137. Mm-hmm. They literally saved tens of thousands of lives by simply using apples and apple pectin.
Well, so what is pectin?
Pectin is just a fiber that is able to pull out, along with some of these heavy metals, bile salts, for example, which can help to accumulate toxins and get stuck in the liver, so they can kind of pull some of that material out, eliminate from the body. So one of the many things you can utilize as a food that, you know, an apple a day keeps the doctor away,
yeah.
An apple a day keeps the Fukushima fallout away, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that old saying, wasn't there?
Definitely.
But it wasn't a pack of French fries a day keeps the doctor away, was it?
No, that keeps the doctor really close and very wealthy.
Keeps them very well. Lots of work for the doctors
exactly.
From that. Sayer, it's been fascinating. Anything else you want to add here at the end before we wrap it up?
So one of the most important things that I think people don't often acknowledge is that when you look at modern drugs, over-the-counter prescribed, the vast majority of them are actually just byproducts of petrochemicals, the chemical industry. And if you look at it from even the lens of the logistics and the finances and the materials, the pharmaceutical industry is really just a subsector of the chemical industry, which is related to the fossil fuel grid and the entire geopolitical nightmare of wars fought forever around the world, which is about acquiring resources from other countries often, you know, taking their oil. So anyway, the idea is that pharmaceuticals are, by definition, xenobiotics. They are foreign to bios, life, the body, and they should never be in the body.
Mm.
There are cases in emergency medicine where a petrochemical drug might actually save a life. So there are exceptions. But in 99.9% of the time for chronic disease or prevention of disease, all they do is create a whole new set of disorders, which then have to be detoxified themselves. So when we start looking at what pharmaceutical products are, we have to acknowledge that the best way to protect yourself from toxicity and to detox is just eliminate them from your lifestyle and your body as best as you can. And that is the number one way that you preserve your health.
That's great advice.
Yeah.
That's great advice, because the reality is that business model is a wonderful business model if you have no conscience, because they're perpetuating disease and creating new symptoms that they can treat. But I think that's great advice. The best way to stay healthy, don't take them.
That's the infinite growth model. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the whole sort of scam of the allopathic model that's beholden to the pharmaceutical industry, is that it produces infinite growth because you're making everyone super sick, new symptoms, new drugs for those symptoms. So you hit it on the head.
Mm. I think you hit it on the head, Sayer. As always, really enjoyed the interview. I may be bigger in stature than you, but I would not want to do a brain comparison, because I know you'd win.
Thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
It's
appreciate
great to
it.
Be here. Thank you. Cool.